You've heard the names of various periods in geologic history upon the planet Earth. You know, the Jurassic, the Cenozoic, the Upper Cretaceous, and so forth. If you follow news about climate change, and it's hard not to, you've probably heard a few people refer to this period in geologic history as the Anthropocene. And the use of anthro is quite deliberate, indicating the impact of people on the planet. Today's guest traveled around the planet, examining that impact and the responses to it. Her book is Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. Gaia Vince is a science journalist whose work as writer and editor has appeared in a number of publications, including Nature, Nature Climate Change, The Guardian, and Australian Geographic, among others. She has also prepared pieces for the radio heard on the BBC and elsewhere, and files video reports on her site, wanderinggaia.com. Gaia Vince, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Good to speak to you, Jeff.
So tell us about the wandering. I mean, what led you to embark upon this journey that led to the book?
Well, I mean, it sounds like a big journey, and it was. It was 2.5 years. I covered more than 40 countries, and yet I hardly saw the planet. I feel like I've hardly seen it, and that just shows how varied it really is. And I wanted to get out there and really see it because I probably, like you, like most people, I spent most of my life working at a desk in an office, not really meeting the people that I was dealing with. And for something of this magnitude, when we're talking about the human impact on the planet, the myriad ways that humans have changed and transformed this planet Earth into a different creature, essentially, what interests me is how it's affecting the people. How is it affecting people in different places where they live, and how are people dealing with that? How are people around the world dealing with the changes that we have made?
And the changes that we have made lead to the use of the term again, Anthropocene. How widely accepted do you find that term to be in science now?
Well, I mean, it is a geological term, as you said. So it actually means the age of humans. So we've had the Jurassic, you know, where dinosaurs were dominant. The human age is something that was decided on, actually, when Paul Crutzen, who's a Nobel Prize winner, he was sitting there thinking, when people were talking about the climate that has changed and the atmospheric chemicals, so the different pollutants, he actually got his prize for predicting the ozone layer decay. So he was just thinking about the changes that we've made to the atmosphere alone, and he suddenly thought, we're not living in the Holocene, which is the era that we're supposed to be living in. We're not living in that epoch anymore. We've changed it so much. We're living in a different age, if you see what I mean. So he came up with the idea of the Anthropocene, and because it's a geological term, it means geologists have to decide upon whether or not to accept or deny it, and they work at very, very slow paces. So,
almost 30 years.
Yeah, basically geologic time. It took them about 30 years even to agree the Holocene, for example. So they've got a big meeting next year to decide on it. But in the meantime, the rest of the world's scientists are biologists, ecologists, sociologists, and some geologists have already sort of taken it on board and further afield than science. You know, culturally it's been taken aboard. So poets and writers and artists are also embracing this idea that we have changed the planet fundamentally. We've changed the types of nature that we have. We've changed the way rivers flow. We've changed the atmosphere. We've changed the oceans. We've changed mountains. We've really dramatically altered this planet, and that's never been done before. So it's quite an extraordinary time to be living. So in terms of a term, it's being used really widely. Whether or not it's agreed officially as this is the epoch and when did it start and all those sorts of decisions, they're geologic decisions. And to a large extent, I'm not that interested in exactly when they decide it starts and finishes, and we can't decide the finish yet, because I'm more interested in the broader idea of it.
There's another term you use in here that I had not seen before called the Great Acceleration. What is that?
Well, the Great Acceleration is something that happened within the lifetime of people alive today, within many people alive today. So it really describes the period since the Second World War, when there was this Great Acceleration, this massive change in how we live as a species. So globalization basically took off. So there was a massive acceleration in everything from population to car production to shipping traffic to everything, to farming, to road building. There was an acceleration in absolutely everything. And this has been a kind of driver. It's a mixture of globalization, of consumerism, of better communication between different places. So the Second World War really initiated this massive mixing of people, because there was an enormous refugee burden and enormous displacement of people after the Second World War. So all this mixing of people, mixing of ideas, improved technologies that came from the war effort, it led to this post-war boom in ideas and consumerism, basically. And that has driven our massive resource use. It's driven a massive population, urbanization, all these things that have led to a changed planet. Before the Second World War, the world was a much stiller place. It was a much quieter place. A lot of people mainly lived in the countryside. They didn't live in cities. And this big change has really driven the Anthropocene.
A lot of changes in what we put into the atmosphere and what has happened to the planet Earth as a result. Gaia Vince is the author of Adventures in the Anthropocene. We do differ somewhat in our pronunciations on different sides of the Atlantic. You'll come back and hear more from Gaia Vince, and you can join the discussion as well on The Exchange. Your phone calls and emails welcome. Back on The Exchange with Gaia Vince and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about climate change, evidence thereof, and ways in which people are trying to forestall or maybe even reverse it. Gaia Vince, Toward the Planet, for Adventures in the Anthropocene, however you choose to pronounce it, a journey to the heart of the planet we made, looking for evidence of climate change, looking for ways in which people are trying to correct what's going on out there. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Gaia, you were talking about sitting at a desk for a lot of your career before you took off for this 2.5 years around the planet. Sitting at that desk, though, working for the likes of Nature and Nature Climate Change, you've had a ringside seat to many reports and studies coming in about climate change. Any one in particular that really hit you in the head?
There are so many, and climate change is just one aspect of this whole thing. I mean, it's a major change, but also I was interested in the fact that we are perhaps causing the fifth greatest extinction in the Earth's history. You know, that's a phenomenal change. The fact that we're logging some of the last pristine rainforests, the fact that almost all the major rivers are now dammed. There are so many changes that we are making to the planet. And really, I think what it was the number of research papers that were coming in, the numbers of studies, and the number of people saying to me, "Look, this massive change has occurred, and it's because of us. You know, it's not just a random change. It's happened because of us." And it made me realize that something quite extraordinary was happening, and I wanted to get out there. I wanted to see, you know, where is it happening? Why? What are we doing? And what are we doing about it?
I'm glad you raised that point. It is not just about climate change. It's about the ways in which you have changed the planet generally, even if the climate were to stay the same. The fact is that, I think you said, what, it's a 12% of the major rivers in the world still flow free?
Tiny. It's a tiny percent, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the book
and most
is...
of most of those the rivers that do flow free flow free are, that's something to say three times very fast.
Right, flow free.
Yeah, most of them are in the Arctic or in the Antarctic. You know, they're in completely inhospitable places. Anything that's in any way near a population of humans has been dammed, it's been rerouted, it's been extracted, it's been polluted. We've really changed it. We've put our own fish in, or we've taken out the native fish. We've really changed the rivers. And when we think of rivers, we think of a wild physical part of our planet that's untouched by people in a lot of ways. You know, you think of the big rivers, but then think of things like the Colorado. You know, it doesn't even reach the sea. A lot of major rivers no longer reach the sea, and that's extraordinary.
You mentioned the Rio Grande and a couple of major ones. There's the Yangtze that doesn't even make it to the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. They don't even make it to the ocean anymore.
Wow.
You know, the Yellow River sometimes runs completely different colors.
Huh.
Yeah.
So the book is divided up into more or less geographic sorts of areas: atmosphere, mountains, rivers, farmlands, oceans, deserts, etc. How did you choose the places to visit?
Well, it was fairly random, actually. I just got a one-way ticket to Kathmandu in Nepal from London. Rented my place out and saw where it took me, really. So it was from one story to another. I was really interested in finding places where change has taken place, where humans have changed it, and then places where humans are dealing with that change and how they're doing it. Because it strikes me that while in the West, you know, in the universities of Britain and America and Australia and Europe, we talk about a lot of these issues, and we talk about them in a very abstract way. Some people are having to deal with these problems, and they're doing it already. We are an incredibly ingenious species, and it's remarkable. It's a great privilege to meet some of these people.
Let's take a call here. We have Anne and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Gaia Vince, the author of Adventures in the Anthropocene.
Thank you. I'm very interested in your topic. And so far, every problem that you've talked about is impacted by overhuman population. China has this one-child policy that it's now mitigating a little bit. But they've received, all over the world, all kinds of criticism for that policy. And in my opinion, it's the smartest thing the human species has ever done. And I'd like to get your opinion.
Thank you. Thanks, Adan. I appreciate it.
Well, so population, yes, our human population is very big. And that is why we're facing resource issues. It's not the only reason. The other reason is that we are using resources a lot more wastefully than we should do. I don't think the Chinese policy was a good one, no, because it was very harmful to a lot of people. Socially, it was incredibly destructive and quite a cruel policy, which they're relaxing slightly. Interestingly, at the same time as they enacted their one-child policy through coercion, Taiwan, by just an economic policy of improving the economy and improving women's freedoms, actually achieved a slightly larger population decrease, per capita population decrease, than China. So that goes to show a trend which is happening across the globe. Population increase has dropped dramatically. We are going to peak. Our population is going to peak. It's going to peak earlier than a lot of people think. Already, the average number of children that a woman has across the globe is less than 3. It's almost at the replacement level. The replacement level is 2.3, something like that, because you have to 2.3 children, because you have to bear in mind that maternal and child mortality.
Mm-hmm. But and as you point out, though,
the population is already declining. The population growth is already declining. We have got a handle on population already.
And the point you're making, and you make it a little more distinctly in the book, is that in countries where the educational level for women is higher, that's where the birth rate is lower.
Yes. Yeah. And just where women have more rights, because women want reproductive rights. And once they have reproductive rights and once they have education, they know about sanitation, they know about providing good food, they can work themselves. And with also urbanization, it goes hand in hand with urbanization, which is another massive trend across the globe. As people live in cities, as women get educated, as sanitation increases, people are having fewer children. They can't afford to have so many. They, you know, when you had a huge farm that you were working manually, you needed some extra hands, and you would divide the farm. Now, that's not the way that most people are living. Population is already massively declining. In a lot of the world, actually, it's a big problem that in the US, the population is still increasing. That's actually bucking the trend for most places. If you look at Europe, we're facing an aging population, a massively declining birth rate. Look at Japan, exactly the same problem. The only way that we are going to manage to look after these old people who are living longer than ever before is by migration. There is no other way. We're going to have to accept a lot more migrants. And look at that politically loaded question. I mean, these are the sorts of things that we are going to have to face and answer and find solutions to in the Anthropocene. We can't bury our heads in the sand and think that we're living in the Holocene anymore. We're not. We're living in a completely different world where we're going to have to shift people around, or Europe will lose its agency for a start, because it's the only places where population is increasing, as I said, is the U.S. and parts of Africa.
We're talking about Adventures in the Anthropocene with Gaia Vince, the author of the book. The subtitle is A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We've Made. It's not just about climate change, but just about ways in which we have changed the nature of the way things work on the planet, nature being a key word there. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a fairly grim point very much at the beginning of the book, which points out, though, that even without population growth, even if population held steady from this moment forward, if the developing world tries to reach the standard of living from the developed world, the environmental impact will be massive.
Well, exactly. We're living in a completely unsustainable way. We really are. And that doesn't seem to have hit home yet at all. But this, we're going to have to find a solution to this. And really, the coming decades are going to be shaped by how the poor get rich. That is the defining factor of what the next decades are going to look like. If the poor get rich in the same way that that Europe got rich or America got rich, well, we're in for a really miserable time on this planet. You know, if we can find another way of doing this, if we can find another way of being comfortable, then who's to say? There's so many opportunities out there.
But as you point out, new development and new technologies need not be quite so impactful upon the planet. So you mentioned going to Nepal first. What did you find in that Wi-Fi network in Nepal that attracted your attention?
Well, this is a really impoverished, cut-off place. So I climbed the Pun Hills of the Himalayas. And these are villages, so they're only accessible by walking for sometimes 2 or 3 days to get to the next village. There's no infrastructure, there's no telephone, there's no internet, there's no electricity, there's no roads. You know, you literally are walking, stepping up and stepping down to get to these places. And yet this retired Nepali school teacher, incredible character, he'd imported illegally, actually, because there was a Maoist coup and you weren't allowed to import anything. He'd imported the American students donated him this home Wi-Fi kit, and he installed it on the tops of some mountains, had these relay stations, and he was able to get internet beamed out basically from Kathmandu to these tiny little villages where you know, people, children under the age of 10 had never even seen anybody outside of their local villages. You know, they're really cut off. And through that, he's bringing the outside world and bringing education, medicine, all sorts of things that can be done through voice over internet, through things like Skype, you know. So you can have lessons in these remote locations suddenly. You can access the internet. Once you can access the internet, you're joined to the world. It's really extraordinary. And what it means is that these people have got, they've got some way of accessing a future. They don't have to leave their village. They don't have to move to Delhi or somewhere. You know, they can stay in their village and earn a living that way. They're yak farmers, you know, so they're selling yak products over the internet. They can process credit card payments that way. They're also making handicrafts, and they're also taking bookings now from tourists. It's enabled tourism to come to these places so that they can get an income that way. And it's keeping alive some of the village traditions and so on. It's really, really quite incredible.
And the teacher actually pushed the Wi-Fi well beyond the range of what it was intended for.
I know. One of the most frustrating things about this is that while I have Wi-Fi in my lounge room, if I'm in the kitchen, which is about 5 meters away, quite often the Wi-Fi cuts out. It's really irritating. And yet he is managing to beam Wi-Fi across hundreds of kilometers.
Much more going on in the Himalayas, though, and elsewhere in the book. You talk about freshwater and glaciers, and a fairly grim situation with glaciers in the Himalayas.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, the Himalayas are in the tropics, just as the Andes are, and these places, they are losing their glaciers through global warming, and it's accelerating, because once the glaciers melt, it exposes black rock, and the black rock absorbs more heat and speeds up the melting, and you get this kind of runaway effect. And these places, being in the tropics, are in some of the driest regions of the planet. It just doesn't, there's no precipitation, it doesn't rain, it's very little snow if it does snow. And the people that live there depend entirely on the little bit of glacial runoff, the meltwater from these glaciers that happens seasonally. They depend on that for their drinking water, but for their crops, for their agriculture. And if the glacier's gone, then all the water source is gone. And again, this means that there's drought and people are moving to Mumbai or somewhere like that.
So I was surprised to see at the figure you provided for the amount of fresh water that comes from glaciers. It's a surprisingly high number.
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's an incredibly important water source. I mean, glaciers are one of the planet's miracles for us. I mean, it's a free water storage. It's entirely free. It's a massive, massive freshwater storage, because the other source of water on the planet is the oceans, and that's all salty. We can't drink it. We can't make use of it except through desalination. It's a big problem, you know. But glaciers provide, you know, they provide the water for the most important rivers on the planet. They provide water in so many ways. They're a really vital part of our planet's climate, of ocean circulation, of everything. And as we lose them, it's having dramatic changes everywhere.
And some surprising responses in different parts of the world to glaciers disappearing. Chewang Norfell, I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation of his name, but in the Himalayas, he was doing something really interesting.
Yeah, this is another one of those incredible characters that I met. So he lives in Ladakh in Leh, which is a tiny corner. At the moment, it's in India. It's a Tibetan population, essentially. It's on the edge of China, Pakistan, India. It's kind of a war-torn area. You know, the Indian and Pakistan and China are all kind of fighting over this little region, and every now and again they have complete blackouts of shooting and so on. But the villagers that live there, they're a really beautiful, beautiful culture. They have incredible clothes and wonderful houses and so on. And a Ladakhi language. They have a culture which is very old, and yet it's disappearing because the people there are disappearing. And the reason they're going is because the water on which they depend, these glaciers, are vanishing, and they're vanishing from one year to the next. It's really quite fast. And when I went there, I met, and it's like 4,000 meters up. That's just the airport. I mean, it's really high. It's a really high altitude desert. takes a long time to get acclimatized to that kind of altitude. I never really did, actually. and I met this guy who is, he's come up with a way of artificially bringing back the glaciers. I mean, it sounds incredible, and I didn't believe it until I saw it. But what he's doing is he's going to, it doesn't work everywhere, but for some of the villages, when the glacier is gone, he's going to that kind of area where he can create a kind of depression in the shadow of a mountain for certain months of the year, and with clever stone walling and directing some flow, any precipitation that lands there, he's kind of settling it and grabbing it and putting it in a depression where it can freeze, and in that way he's making an artificial glacier. It's ingenious.
Wow, artificial glaciers. And then we'll talk about mountain painting as well when we come back to talk more with Gaia Vince. Her book is Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Gaia, and with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you again for listening. Today we're talking about Adventures in the Anthropocene, a book by Gaia Vince, who has worked as a writer and editor for Nature, Nature Climate Change, The Guardian, and a whole bunch of other publications and broadcast outlets as well, in which she looked for impacts of people on the planet. People impact on the planet is the reason we call this the Anthropocene. Scientists are beginning to catch on with that. Anthropocene or Anthropocene, depending on your own particular pronunciation. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about impacts on the planet and ways in which people are trying to rectify those or mitigate what we've done. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we just talked about manufacturing glaciers. A way to take low-lying areas and fill them with water and let the water freeze. Artificial glacier, in a sense. Now, you also traveled to South America and had people painting mountains in the Peruvian Andes. Is that right?
I mean, doesn't that sound incredible? And I guess it's a mark of just how desperate people are that they would even consider painting a mountain. I mean, it sounds like something out of a fairy story, doesn't
it? It does.
Some sort of Herculean task. But yes, again, this is the principle that that white, that glaciers that are white and snow reflects heat, so it keeps an area cool. And once the glacier disappears, you get the black rock underneath. It absorbs it, and you get this cycling, this speeding up of melting. So in Peru, in the Andes, where the glaciers are disappearing faster than anywhere else in the tropics, and it's a really, really big problem. Some of these small alpaca villages who depend on the glacier melt to water the alpaca pastures, and without that they have to travel to places like Lima. You know, they have to join the slums. Basically, they just become slum people because they lose their farming livelihoods. To slow that down, what they've decided to do is paint the mountain white in a kind of way of mimicking the ice that would have been there. And by painting the mountain white, they hope that will make it reflect more heat, so it will cool down, so any precipitation, any snow that lands there will freeze, and the cycle will be reversed. So when I went there, they painted quite a large area white. I mean, it involves trekking up mountains with a bucket of, I think it was kind of egg white, and that was to make it sticky and chalky paint. And they're just sort of like throwing it from the buckets onto the mountain. And I mean, I was quite impressed with how much they'd done. And already, apparently, it's cooling the area, and a little bit of ice is beginning to form, and it melts by about 10 o'clock. And what they're aiming to do eventually is to pump water up above this and let it trickle slowly down. They're going to use a little wind turbine to pump it up. and then the water should freeze, and then that should be cold enough that more water will freeze on top, and then a glacier will build up eventually. So they're trying to make an artificial glacier that way. I mean, you know, good luck to them. I don't know how successful they'll be, but they're pretty desperate. They want to try anything. Everybody wants to try something before they have to, you know, leave their home of their ancestors, their grandparents, their whole family, their parents' graves. You know, they want to try something, however absurd it might seem. Are we going to spray the Andes mountain chain white? You know, I mean, I'm not sure how useful this is for grander schemes, but maybe it is. Maybe it is. I mean, in Europe already, people are trying to wrap up the remaining glaciers in the Alps, in the Swiss and German Alps. They're trying to they put reflective blankets over them, and that's not because they need it for their meal, because you know, like, we're not that desperate. It's just to prolong the ski season, you know. So perhaps it's not so crazy to paint a mountain.
You know, when I think about these projects, though, it brings us into the realm of geoengineering, which is the term alone makes people uncomfortable, particularly if you start talking about controls in the atmosphere and stuff like that. But it's interesting in the context of your book now to think about how uncomfortable we are with the idea of changing the planet in that way versus the ways in which we have already changed it profoundly.
Well, exactly. We're already geoengineering the planet. You know, we evolved onto a completely different planet. There were all number of species that were there that we've got rid of. There was a completely different landscapes. We've covered natural landscapes of forest and savanna. We've covered it with farmland, artificial land called farms, called agriculture. We've put cities there. We've completely changed. We've transformed the planet. We've transformed the climate. We've completely geoengineered our planet. But I guess it's now time to sort of say, well, we're very powerful. We can do all these things. But shouldn't we be doing it consciously? Shouldn't we be making decisions? Shouldn't we be deciding, this is a species that we want to keep. We need to work out how to keep it. Or this is the type of climate we need for our survival. We need to work out how to keep it. And whatever it takes, we need to explore the options. I'm not saying that we should be erecting space mirrors or creating artificial rain, although people are doing that. People are already trying that sort of thing. But we need to think about the options. We need to think, and not just short-termism. We need to think for the next few decades at the very least, because we're doing things now which have an impact later. Once we make a species extinct, it's gone forever. You know, we're now working out ways to bring things back. You know, there's a team of scientists who are trying to bring back Neanderthals and trying to bring back mammoths. But these are small projects. What about if we lose honeybees? You know, where will we be then if we don't have pollinators? We won't be able to eat. Where there are very few crops that we use, there are very few types of food that don't use pollinators. Already there's a big industry in trucking bees from farm to farm.
Oh yes.
And that's incredible, isn't it? You know, that we live in that sort of world where that's necessary, and that's the way that we are changing the planet. We're changing it in the way that we now truck pollinators around. We don't just rely on them. I mean, this has changed in a generation, it less than that. In the last few decades, that's the sort of thing that's happening. And so now we need to consciously think about, what are we going to do? Because some things we can do ourselves. Some things we can do artificially. You know, there are some glaciers which we can artificially recreate. There are some types of pollination which we can artificially take over the jobs of bees. But it's normally more expensive. You know, if we get rid of all the glaciers, we've got reservoirs, but how many reservoirs are we going to have to build to replace the glaciers we're destroying? I mean, it's incredible number. It's a very expensive undertaking. It's a massive infrastructure project, and we're not even starting on it yet. So we really need to start having these conversations, and we need to start thinking about how we're going to replace the nature we're destroying, the natural systems we're destroying, for our own survival, and whether that's you know, some of the more controversial geoengineering methods, whether it's Some of the things like, you know, we already have fish farms rather than fishing wild fish. You know, these are the ways that we're already trying to come up with solutions. But we need there are a lot more solutions we need to make. Basically, if we get rid of the Amazon rainforest, as some people fear that we may well do because of drought and because of logging and that sort of thing. You know, how are we going to clean the planet's atmosphere in the way that the forests do naturally? These are big questions that we need to start thinking about answering.
They truly are, and they're certainly raised in the book Adventures in the Anthropocene. Gaia Vince is the author and our guest on The Exchange. Here's a phone call from Rika in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, Gaia.
Hello.
I have to agree that humans have been changing the planet. And changing the climate. And first we cooled it off and made it wetter with our sprinkler irrigation right up to the 80s when we got the idea that we had to save water. And since then we've been cutting back on sprinklers, using drip, you know, just cutting back on irrigation, period. And by gosh, it's warming back up and drying out.
You mentioned this theory before, so you're saying that if we were still throwing water around a little more freely, that the climate would be different?
Especially us here on the West Coast, where the prevailing wind comes from the ocean, it blows our irrigation water uphill and upstream. It all depends on location. Now, in India, they have managed to short-circuit their monsoons by over-irrigating in the north, which cooled off the area and no longer drew the monsoons all the way to the north, and so they're falling heavier in the south and not falling in the north. So it's all a matter of location, but we on the West Coast can share our water with the rest of the country simply by using it with a sprinkler.
Interesting thought. Okay, thanks for that, Rika. Appreciate it. And there's a lot in the book about water in particular. In fact, you say in the rivers section, Gaia, that it's perhaps more important than any other category. Have you heard a theory, anything like what Rika's talking about?
I'm not entirely sure what that is, but it's true that we can have localized effects in various different ways. You know, if we spray water around, then the air is wetter. Of course it is. I'm talking about global effects here and regional effects rather than little effects. And the way that we irrigate our crops is incredibly important, especially in areas where we don't get enough precipitation, where it's dry. And in India particularly, most of the irrigated water comes from groundwater, and the groundwater is declining at an absolutely alarming rate, and it's a national emergency now what they're going to do about it, because they're pumping ever deeper, they're not finding enough water, and there are millions and millions of people depending on very little water. So, and the monsoon is coming, but it's coming, it's more erratic, it's coming at different times, and the El Nino effect is strong there. People, I mean, I've visited villages in India that have managed to overcome drought and water uncertainty through innovative methods. Through different village political situations where they've all come together and all decided on a course of action and really followed that, whether it's drip irrigation or building reservoirs or replenishing the ground water table, or deciding on certain non-thirsty crops. Instead of planting cash crops like cotton, they've planted more drought-tolerant crops. So, there are ways around all of these things. It's just a case of actually really thinking about it and really planning. I mean, we're not planning enough, and we're not taking into account the fact that the planet and the climate and the soils and so many aspects of the planet that we took for granted before have fundamentally changed. We're still living as though we're in this different world where we have, you know, a small population, plentiful resources, a temperate easy Holocene climate. We're not in that situation anymore. We're in the Anthropocene. There are going to be 10 billion people. There are limited resources. The climate is no longer stable. It's warmer. We've got to think about these things.
We have an email along those lines from Jenny, I think, in Roseburg. She says, since the environmental destruction and emerging concerns about the environment and the human race's involvement and essentially causing of these environmental concerns, it's a global issue. She says, I was wondering, what do you think it would take for all the countries on Earth to agree to and implement an environmental revolution and rebuilding of our environment and protecting it? That from Jenny.
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? Because we haven't made much headway in certain fields. There's some examples where we have, you know, so in certain types of conservation, we've done quite well. If you look at the Convention for the Control of the Ozone Layer, we've protected that. So in some ways, we're quite good at international agreements. When it comes to climate change, well, I'm seeing some progress now, but I'm not seeing it along international agreed targets, for example. I think it's voluntary. Countries are voluntarily coming out with their own targets. So I'm not sure that an international agreement is ever going to happen. I don't know, but I don't know. We can't even agree on international emergencies like what to do about Syria. So I don't know if that's what's going to happen. I think what's going to happen probably is more a mixture of grassroots things. People are crowdfunding energy projects. That's very interesting that's happening. And countries independently deciding on something and going along those lines. Look at the energy policies of places like Denmark.
As the book proves, there are lots of efforts going on already. It's called Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. Gaia Vince wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Gaia, thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
All right, take care.